What do you remember from yesterday's class? You are so self-controlled that you have conquered even me, who am unconquerable for those who cannot control their senses. What is the meaning of that? Why has Krishna made this restriction? Is it a restriction? What is the meaning of that? He's unconquerable by those who have not controlled their senses, and he is conquered. He is conquered by those who are able or have conquered their senses. Yes, keep going.
And if you conquer the mind and fix it on Krishna.
It's a practical consideration. That, yeah.
Otherwise, we sense senses.
Because of, what does it mean to be a servant of Krishna? What does it mean to be without false ego? It means that one's consciousness is focused in Krishna consciousness, which means the acknowledgement and the acting according to the principle that we are Krishna's servants, that we are not independent from Krishna. Krishna, I am your servant. Please, my desire is that you let me know how I can serve you, and I will serve you. So the opposite of that is when one is under the control of one's senses, because the two, serving Krishna, which is selfless, based on love, and the other, of serving the senses, which is selfish and self-centered, both are controlled externally. The soul is controlled externally in both cases. But when we're self-centered, that's the exact opposite of being in love and serving Krishna and loving devotion. So the two cannot exist, like generosity and selfishness cannot exist simultaneously, fully, in someone's consciousness. Because if one is selfish, one cannot be generous. And even the so-called generosity done for selfish reasons is not true generosity. In other words, I do this, I'm generous, I'm charitable, I do this social work because it makes me feel good. So there, I'm in the center. So it's not true magnanimity of heart. Because always, I'm sure, having to make sure that I'm getting back something. And as soon as I don't get back what I want to get back, then I cut off my generosity. So it's not actually generosity at all. It's always been self-centered, and it was just self-centeredness in the disguise of generosity. So Krishna consciousness is far from that. It is completely opposed to that principle. The principle of Krishna consciousness is purity. Anya bilasita sanyam gyana kamana vita anakulena Krishna anashilanam bhakti uttamam. Now, we've been recently hearing about quite a few demons that were killed by Krishna. While Krishna was acquiring his 16,100 wives, who did he kill? Who?
Narakasur,
whose name was also Bhomasura. So what were the characteristics of Bhomasura? He was very powerful. He was Krishna's own son. There's no mention of where he got his power from, is there? Is it? Does anyone remember where he got his power from? He got it, that was his mother, but he didn't. I don't think it mentioned that she gave him all power, did it? But there's no mention of where he got his power from. But he was Krishna's son, so that naturally he was empowered. He was naturally it would make the person powerful. But Krishna killed him. And Krishna was so amazed even by the fortifications of his kingdom, but yet he was so powerful, but Krishna killed him. Now, right before he killed Bhomasura, who did he kill?
Mura.
Mura, exactly. And the descriptions of Mura are quite astounding, because Mura, who is he more or less compared to? Does anyone remember? Who does Mura resemble? Who? Lord Shiva. He was as powerful, he was so effulgent you couldn't look at him. And if you looked at him, you couldn't see him due to his effulgence. And when he arose from the water in which he was sleeping, he was so powerful. And how many heads did he have? Five heads. And Lord Shiva is also known as Panchamukha. And he was so powerful. He arose out of the water. What was the expression used? And he appeared to have the power to destroy the universe. Even maybe someone can look and see what the expression is. So he's actually compared to Lord Shiva. But what's the difference between Mura and Lord Shiva? Is Lord Shiva is a great devotee, and Mura was a great demon. And what does it mean to be a demon? It means to be opposed to Krishna. So therefore, Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita there are only two kinds of living entities in this world, the divine and the demonic. There's not gray. There's no gray ground between. You're either on this side or you're on this side. But the closest to gray as it comes is someone who is on the demonic side, who wishes to move towards the divine side. So he's aspiring to be a devotee through becoming a servant of a devotee. But yet his consciousness is self-centered. And someone with self-centered consciousness in a specific circumstance is capable of doing anything demonic, as the history of the world shows, no matter how good people appear, but in circumstances they'll do horrible things, practically speaking. So Mura was a demon, even not as powerful as Lord Shiva, but he was resembling Lord Shiva in power, and Krishna killed him. And then Krishna killed Bhomasura. And then next, who does he deal with? Okay, Pondraka, he's a demon imitating Krishna. He's like, even to the point of having extra arms placed around his body, as if that is going to make one the Supreme Lord, and he's surrounded by his demonic followers. He's convinced himself of that. And then there's Vidvid, who was a devotee, but he was influenced unfavorably. He was a devotee of Lord Rama and influenced unfavorably by Bhanasura, and he became demonic because of that. And then there's Bhanasura himself, who has influenced two personages, Bhomasura and Vidvid, into becoming demonic, being opposed to Krishna. And he's extremely powerful due to the mercy of a devotee. And that devotee is Lord Shiva. So it's quite interesting. Then compare Lord Shiva to Mura. Lord Shiva was really Lord Shiva, and Mura was like Lord Shiva in great power, but one was killed and one was spared because Lord Shiva was actually Lord Shiva. He was actually a devotee. And not only was he spared, but Bhanasura, who was opposed to Krishna and was ready to fight with Krishna, and he was fighting with Krishna, and he was angry at all the time at all of Krishna's victories. He was so opposed to Krishna. But he was spared from death, from being killed by Krishna, different from Bhomasura, by the mercy of a real devotee, Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva, as the Acharyas explain, he wasn't actually, even when fighting with Krishna, there was a similarity between how Bhomas, Banasura was acting and Mura was acting. They were both fighting with Krishna, but Lord Shiva was not fighting with Krishna, Lord Shiva and Mura. He was actually not, he was fighting with Lord Krishna and he was in that spirit, but his mood was different, which was described by Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. So there's quite a few interesting parallels in there. And Bhomasura, again, was killed while Banasura was saved by the mercy of a devotee. And he was actually turned into a devotee. And he had wonderful qualities, and Bhomasura had wonderful qualities. And interestingly enough, Banasura, how did he gain the favor of Lord Shiva? Playing drums while Lord Shiva was doing his nritya, his dancing. So he was doing something, one could say, you know, it was very pleasing to Lord Shiva, but it wasn't extremely significant in the sense of done something for his whole lifetime. But Lord Shiva, who was the devotee who saved him, he was pleased. And that's all that matters when it has to do with getting the mercy of a devotee. He just has to be pleased. And it doesn't make a difference, again, why he's pleased, or if he or someone else may be doing something for him, a devotee, and he's not pleased in the same way. It's just a matter of the kind disposition of the pleasure-giving force of the Lord, the Lord's kripa shakti, which the devotee is carrying. So this is, again, hinting at the relationships between Krishna, who is a demon, who is a devotee, what does it mean to be a devotee, and what's the relationship between a soul and the devotee, and what really makes the difference in someone's life and how one's life is going to end. So these points are I found very interesting. And then in 72, another demon gets slayed. And who is that in chapter 72? Durasanda. And was he a demon? He was a big demon. And was he even a worshipper of someone. There's no mention of Mura worshipping anyone. There's no mention of Bhomasura worshipping anyone, if I remember correctly. There's mention of Banasura worshipping, but here is someone who's worshipping. Who is he worshipping? Who is Jarasandha worshipping?
Mahabharav.
Huh?
Mahabharav.
And who is Mahabharav? Lord Shiva. So he's also a worshipper of Lord Shiva. But what's the difference between his worshipping of Lord Shiva and who's the other one who worshipped Lord Shiva? Manasura. One was killed and one was saved. What's the difference?
Attitude.
Huh?
Pleasing the devotee.
It's a matter of pleasing him, because there's no mention of Mahabharata being pleased with him. And look what he was trying to do to please Mahabharav. What was he trying to do? He was performing human sacrifice. He was going to kill all these kings and offer them bloody to Mahabharav. And look what the little thing that Banasura did and pleased Lord Shiva. He just played the drum. Well, Lord Shiva wanted the drum being played. It enhanced what Lord Shiva was, what his desire was, his service was. His service was to destroy at that time. And he cooperated, he enhanced Lord Shiva's desire. And he pleased him in that way. And look at the extreme that Jarasandha was doing to please Lord Shiva. And the result was he was killed. And Lord Shiva didn't come to protect him or anything. So it's quite interesting when one analyzes the qualities of these asuric personages and the relationship between devotees and them. And see why there is, I believe there is a mention of why Jarasandha, why he was doing that. Was that mentioned in yesterday's class? He was undefeated. But it says he was trying to please him in this way. Maybe we'll find it in a different place. Now, I'd also like to read one more series of points. In chapter 70, which chapter was... What happened in chapter 69? Does anyone remember? Narada Muni comes and visits Dwarka. And then in 70, what happens?
One day, Krishna.
Yeah, Krishna's daily activities are described. And then at the end of Krishna's daily activities, there are two wonderful occurrences after, while Krishna is in the Sudama Assembly Hall. What's the first wonderful occurrence?
An unknown person.
And I don't know if Mataji mentioned this, Narayani Mataji, but it's such an interesting description of when he enters. Listen to this. Once a certain person arrived in the assembly, an unknown person. This is 22 in chapter 70. O king, who had never been seen there before. The doorkeepers announced him to the Lord and then escorted him inside. So one interesting point on this is what? That a person who was unknown, no one had seen before, was allowed access to see the king into the assembly hall. And this was actually the standard, that the citizens had access. And not only the citizens had access to see the ruler, but even foreigners who were visiting had access. There's one, I heard a lecture where Ridhanda Maharaj described this. I can't remember which kingdom it was, at which times in the Vedic kingdoms it was, that one king had a golden rope that came from his palace to the center of town. And this rope was attached to a bell. And if anyone had a complaint, they would pull the rope and it would get the king's attention. So responsive the rulers were to those they ruled. And what do you think the result would be in someone's consciousness who is a citizen, who is in the kingdom, if their king or ruler was so responsive to the difficulties they were having, what do you think would take birth within their consciousness? Huh? Trust, loyalty, they would do anything, love even. They would feel so safe. And why would the king do it? Because his consciousness was supposed to be, his consciousness was, if they were like that, that the citizens were considered like the praja, like one's own children. And just as a parent is naturally attuned to the needs and desires and problems of the child, so similarly was the king. So the doorkeepers announced him to the Lord and then escorted him inside. It's probably in the Krishna book, the description that I was looking for, but maybe let me just see, and then we'll continue with this too. Yes, listen to this. Take it. Who is Krishna? Oh, I've asked a very difficult question. Sorry, because you can't figure out what in the world is he thinking? What kind of an answer is he looking for? But who is Krishna in the simplest way? So he's God, right? He's the Parameshwara, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And people in this world, generally, who have some piety, they worship God. And how did they envision him? Even in the Western world, listen to this description. As the Almighty Supreme Lord would seat himself on his exalted throne there in the assembly hall, he's shown with his unique effulgence, illuminating all the quarters of space. Anyway, especially in the Krishna book, the way it was written, it sounded to me so much how people in the Western culture, especially, perhaps, conceive of God. He's sitting on his throne and with a great, great effulgence, and the effulgence is so great that you cannot perceive who he is or anything like that. He's very, very unknown, his unique effulgence, and he's got his assembly hall. And someone may be sitting on his right side, someone sitting on his left side, those who are dear to him. It's like a glimpse into Krishna's assembly hall here. But then the rest of it fades because those religionists don't know that Krishna is really a person. So jesters would entertain the Lord by displaying various comic moods. So in other words, he was in the mood of a king. So in any case, that certain assembly person arrived in the assembly hall and he, with joined palms, he bowed down, and with joined palms he described to the Lord how a number of kings were suffering because Charastanda had imprisoned them. 20,000 kings who had refused to submit absolutely to Jarasandha during his world conquest had been forcibly imprisoned by him in the fortress named Girivraja. So it is not Giriraja, even though there is Raja in Girivraja and there is Giriraja in Vraja. But this is a different place altogether. It's Girivraja. And this is what the king said. Now, I'm going to read the prayers fairly quickly, but what is the essence of these prayers? O Krishna, this is the prayers of the kings who are imprisoned by Jarasandha. O Krishna, O immeasurable soul, destroyer of fear for those surrendered to you, despite our separatist attitude, we have come to you for shelter out of fear of material existence. So they were Chatur Vidha, Bhajante Imam, Dana Sukritina Vajina, Artha Gigyasa Artha Ti, Gyani Cha Bharatasava. They were fearful and they were taking shelter of Krishna. People in this world are always engaged in sinful activities and are thus bewildered about their real duty, which is to worship you according to your commandments. This activity would truly bring them good fortune. Let us offer our obeisances unto the all-powerful Lord, who appears as time and suddenly cuts down one's stubborn hope for a long life in this world. So this is the situation. They're practically representing every living entity in who is conditioned and within a material body, fearful, stopped by the witch of time, the time for cutting down our stubborn hopes for a long life in this world. They continue, and therefore a pious person will take shelter of him. You are the predominating Lord of the universe and have descended into this world with your personal power to protect the saintly and suppress the wicked. So therefore, they find themselves neither saintly nor wicked. Wicked is Jarasandha, and saintly ones don't need distress to take shelter of the Lord. They're in between. But we cannot understand, O Lord, how anyone can transgress your law and still continue to enjoy the fruits of his work. Who are they speaking about? How is it possible? So is this is this something that you perceive in this world? The demonic seem to prosper and the devotees seem to suffer. The saintly don't suffer, because the nature of a saintly person is that he's above suffering. He's above identifying with the difficulties that confront him in life. That is not him, that is due to his karma. And he's fixed in that consciousness, seeing that somehow or another there is medicine and help from Krishna. Krishna's direct hand is involved in this difficulty that I'm in. This is what makes one a saint. Jivati, oh, mukti pade, sadayabak. So they don't suffer, but the sinful, they can. It appears that they're enjoying, and those who are in between, like the kings are, who are aspiring to be saintly, but are still, what's the difference between the saintly and the kings? Essentially, is one is surrendered, seeing Krishna as the center and everything, and the kings, because they're in between, means that they desire, but still they desire to serve Krishna and surrender to Krishna, but they are still selfish. They're still entrapped and wrapped by false ego. And therefore they take shelter of Krishna because of their suffering. On the other hand, Mother Yasoda does something for Krishna because of she's afraid that he's going to suffer. What we look for the motivating force. So they continue, how is it that this Jarasandha, who's sinful, who's against you, who's a demon, he's enjoying, and we, the saintly, are aloof, and the intermediate, we're suffering but and going to be sacrificed by him. But how is it that he's enjoying? You are the predominating Lord. How can someone go against your will and have descended in this world with your personal power to protect the saintly and suppress the wicked? We cannot understand, O Lord, how anyone can transgress your law and still continue to enjoy the fruits of his work. How is it possible Jarasandha is so successful? O Lord, with this corpse-like body always full of fear, we bear the burden of the relative happiness of kings, which is just like a dream. Thus we have rejected the real happiness of the soul, which comes by rendering selfless service to you. Being so very wretched, we simply suffer in this life under the spell of your illusory energy. Therefore, since your feet relieve the sorrow of those who surrender to them, please release us prisoners from the shackles of karma, manifest as the king of Magda. So what does that mean? Did you go over this in detail yesterday? Was that a yes or a no, or somewhere in between? Okay, so I'm maybe being redundant.
Went through it, but you don't know which detail do you mean.
Okay, yes. But you went through it carefully. Okay. So, how interesting. Look at their vision of these imprisoned souls. They're learning how to see. Release us prisoners from the shackles of karma. Our karma manifested as the king of Magda. So they're not actually just seeing him as the fault, him as the problem, but they're seeing, this is our karma. What does that mean? When you see a suffering that you are experiencing as a manifestation of your karma, then where does the fault lie? Yeah. Very different consciousness than thinking, please kill this Jarasandha because he's a demon, because he's causing us all this suffering. So they are surrendering, they're actually surrendering to Krishna. And now describing Jarasandha, his power, wielding alone the prowess of 10,000 men and elephants, he has locked us up in his house, just as a lion captures sheep. We can't rescue ourselves. This is a situation of every conditioned soul. We cannot rescue ourselves, even though we conceive of ourselves as kings, you know, as the lord of our kingdom, our teeny kingdoms. We're imagining that up until the time where cruel time cuts down our stubborn hopes, we're imagining that we have our little kingdoms. O wielder of the disc, which is time itself, your strength is unlimited, and thus 17 times you crushed Jarasandha in battle. But then, absorbed in human affairs, you allowed him to defeat you once. Now he is so filled with pride that he dares to torment us, your subjects, we're your devotees, we are surrendered to you. O unconquerable one, please rectify the situation. Now, this is the message of the kings imprisoned by Jarasandha, who all hanker for your audience. What? They want to see Krishna. Because why? It's natural, because they have surrendered to his feet. So naturally, they want his audience. Please bestow good fortune on these poor souls. So then what happens in the pastime?
Narada.
Okay. And what are the members of the Yadu dynasty, just immediately Narada Muni came, bearing a mass of golden matted locks of hair. So, and then the issue came, where should Krishna go? And of course, we know that, of course, Krishna can't be in two places at once, because he's just been in 16,108 places at once. So how could he be in two places at once? Big, big problem. So they ask Uddhava to solve the problem, and Uddhava comes out with a logical, wonderful, brilliant analysis that Jarasandha has to be defeated before Yudhisthira can perform the Rajasuya sacrifice anyway, because you have to be the undisputed emperor of the world to perform the sacrifice. So the plan is made. Then Lord Krishna travels to Indraprastha, and that was so, I found that so wonderful, because there was such a huge entourage. Just imagine how much luggage there was when he was traveling with 16,108 queens. It was huge. There were washermen and cooks. Everyone was in this entourage. So Krishna traveled to Indraprastha to see Yudhisthira, and then there was a wonderful description of the devotees, such as Maharaj Yudhisthira, seeing Krishna. Bhima, his eyes brimming with tears. One usually doesn't think of Bhima as one with eyes brimming with tears. His eyes were brimming with tears, that's in 27. And he laughed with joy as he embraced his maternal cousin Krishna. And then Arjuna and the twins, Nakul Sahadev, also joyfully embraced their dear most friend. And they all cried. These were powerful warriors who killed. Warriors' business is to kill. And there they were, all crying. Because Krishna, it's the nature of wonderful Krishna. So everyone welcomed Krishna. And Mother Kunti welcomed Krishna. And Draupadi worshipped all of Krishna's wives. And interestingly enough, desiring to please King Yudhisthira, the Lord resided in Indraprastha for several months. So what's especially interesting about that is that there were the kings imprisoned, and Jarasandha was going to kill them. And Krishna said, yes, the messengers came, said, we're suffering so much under this rascal demon Jarasandha, who appears to be enjoying like anything, despite him being a rascal wicked demon. And here we are suffering, please save us. And Krishna decided not to manifest into two, but just kept as one, and he brought everyone to Hastinapur. And then instead of just jumping off and going to Patna, where our Jarasandha was living in Bihar, he was the second most powerful Bihari. The first, of course, is Ras Bihari. Krishna waited for several months before going to save them. That's quite astounding. I mean, what do you think so? What do you think? Yeah. I think actually in the Krishna book it may even say 3 months, but here the verse says several months. And then, so why did he do it? To please his devotee Yudhisthira. But how about his devotees who were in prison in Giri Vraja? And then just imagine, and this we can imagine, what their consciousness was like. They were devotees of Krishna. They knew that Krishna was going to save them because they had begged him. They had gone to him for shelter. They were devotees. What does it mean to be a devotee? It means trusting that your Lord goes to te varanam tata, that your Lord's going to save you. And then one day would come, and they think, oh, maybe Krishna will come and save us today. And then the day passes and the night falls. No Krishna. Then the next day, the sun comes up. Maybe Krishna will come today. The night falls again, and Krishna doesn't come. Day after day after day. Now they're devotees. They're not wavering souls. They've surrendered. They've given themselves to Krishna. So each day they have great expectation and hope. Today Krishna will come. Today Krishna will come. And then one day, it happens. Krishna comes. And he saves them. And he takes such good care of them too. He comes in disguise even. How interesting. But one day, Krishna comes. And then And then the demon Jarasandha is killed, and that's where we begin. And the kings are liberated. And we will begin. No, did you? Oh, you read 73 yesterday, yes? I got confused, huh? Oh, so you didn't read 73? Okay. Then I'm understanding correctly. So this is why. One of the reasons why I wanted to go over what we read so what were the kings? What was their main thought? What did the prayers through the messenger? What were they thinking? They're asking because they're surrendered souls, they're devotees. And how is this Jarasandha enjoying? And we, your surrendered devotees, suffering so much. Then, now we begin texts 1 through 6. Sukadeva Goswami said, Jarasandha had defeated 20,800 kings. He had defeated so many kings. How many? 800. In combat and thrown them into prison. As these kings emerged from the Giri Droni fortress, they appeared dirty and shabbily dressed. They were emaciated by hunger, their faces were dried up, and they were greatly weakened by their long imprisonment. The kings, now hear the difference, the kings then beheld the Lord before them. His complexion was dark blue like the color of a cloud. He wore a yellow silk garment. He was distinguished by the Srivats mark on his chest, his four mighty arms, so he was in a forearm form when they saw him. The pinkish hue of his eyes, which resembled the whirl of a lotus, this is what the kings saw when they looked and saw their deliverer. His lovely, cheerful face, his gleaming makkara earrings, and the lotus club conch shell and disc in his hands, a helmet, a jeweled necklace, a golden belt, and a golden golden bracelets and armlets decorated his form. And on his neck he wore the brilliant, precious Kastuba gem and a garland of forest flowers. Why didn't Krishna just kill him, Jarasandha, himself? Why doesn't Krishna deliver all the devotees from their difficulty directly? He does that usually through his devotees. A helmet, a jeweled necklace, a golden belt, golden bracelets and armlets decorated his form. And on his neck, he wore both the brilliant, precious Kastuba gem and a garland of forest flowers. The kings seemed to drink his beauty with their eyes, lick him with their tongues, relish his fragrance with their nostrils, and embrace him with their arms. Their past sins now eradicated, the kings all bowed down to Lord Hari, placing their heads at his feet. There's a description in the chapter 23 of the 10th canto of when the Dvijapatnis saw Krishna. It's very similar, if I remember correctly. Maybe you can just look at when they saw Krishna. I mean, not they didn't see him in a forearm form, but they seemed to drink his beauty with their eyes, lick him with their tongues, and relish his fragrance with their nostrils and embrace him with their arms. Krishna entered the hearts of the Dvijapatnis through their eyes, just through him seeing them and them seeing him. And they embraced him. Could you read it?
For a long time, those Brahmana ladies had heard about Krishna Devadatta, and his glories had become a constant ornaments of their ears. Indeed, their minds were always absorbed in him.
Like the kings. This is the qualification for a devotee, having heard and then absorbing the mind.
Through the apertures of their eyes, they now forced him to enter within their hearts, and then they embraced him within for a long time. In this way, they finally gave up the pain of separation from him, just as sages give up the anxiety of false ego by embracing their innermost consciousness.
The ecstasy, just let us enter into this mysterious statement. The ecstasy, and mysterious because how can we understand what it is like being conditioned souls? How can we understand what it is like to actually see Krishna described so beautifully? The ecstasy of beholding Lord Krishna, having dispelled the weariness of their imprisonment. The king stood with joint palms and offered words of praise to that supreme master of the senses. The king said, now, their prayers, 9 verses, 8 to 16, I specifically wanted to read the prayers of the kings from the messenger. So it's in the freshness of our minds. When we hear, so that was the prayers of someone who was captured and suffering and seeing it as to their fate and taking shelter of Krishna. Now they've seen Krishna. Their problem has been solved. And what are they going to say? And interestingly, compare that to what they previously said through the messenger. Obeisances to you, O Lord of the ruling demigods, O destroyer of your surrendered devotees' distress. Since we have surrendered to you, O inexhaustible Krishna, please save us from this terrible material life which has made us so despondent. So what's the prime difference there, even revealed in that first, this first prayer, from what they said previously? Yeah.
Before they asked for liberation from imprisonment, and here they ask
for liberation from imprisonment. But just the concept of what imprisonment really means has changed. And they were thinking then that that imprisonment was causing their despondency and distress. And now they're getting really to the root of the problem, what the cause of distress is. It's not placing the blame on the externals. They weren't even so much doing that before, in one sense. They were seeing it as their fate, but they wanted release from their fate, their karma, in the form of Jarasandha, because they're devotees, and that's how devotees tend to look at what Krishna consciousness means, that God's purpose is to remove my suffering, which is why most people come to the Supreme Lord. But the concept of remove my suffering is in the prime stage, so I can stop suffering and enjoy myself. And in the ultimate stage, it's the same, but the concept of what the cause of suffering is and what the cause of enjoyment and what the pleasurable activities are, they're quite different. So please save us from this terrible material life which has made us so despondent. This is verse 8. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Deva Devasya indicates Krishna's supreme position as the Lord. The phrase Panartihara, remover of the distress of the surrendered souls, indicates Krishna's affection for his devotees. Avyaya, inexhaustible, expresses Krishna's unchanging transcendental nature. So what is the unchanging transcendental nature that Krishna has? First name that's given is what? Deva Devesha, which means he's the supreme position as the Lord. So he's the supreme Lord. And the third name is Avyaya, indicating his unchanging transcendental nature. And he's the supreme Lord, and he has an unchanging transcendental nature. And in the second name, it tells us what that unchanging, of course he has many unchanging aspects to his nature, but the one that we're particularly interested in and here to note is that he's the prapanartihara, the remover of the distress of the surrendered. This is encouragement for us to surrender. He's unchanging, unfailing in this. And he has the power to do it because he's the Supreme Lord. Their second prayer. O Master Madhusudan, we do not blame this king of Magadha, since it is actually by your mercy that kings fall from their royal position, O Almighty Lord. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments. The king said, we do not find fault with Jarasandha for usurping, stealing our kingdoms, because by this we have obtained your mercy. So, in the distress that they were feeling, the first principle that we heard in their previous verses was that they weren't seeing the distress as caused by the external cause of their distress, but rather they were seeing their distress as being caused by their own karma. And then, after they blossom in their realization due to having seen Krishna, they understand that the distress as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, was being caused not by Jarasandha, or rather that it wasn't his fault, but actually because of the distress that he had caused, we have obtained your mercy. So what? So this is wonderful. How to turn the cause of misery into the cause of great wonderment and happiness. This is certainly, if one can do this, how can one be miserable in this world? If every miserable thing that happens gets turned into a cause of happiness, then there's nothing miserable that happens. Now their vision is really mature. Now they're going to explain their situation previously, 9 through 11, three verses. Infatuated with his opulence and ruling power, a king loses all self-restraint and cannot obtain his true welfare. Thus bewildered by your illusory energy, he imagines his temporary assets to be permanent. So again, what king in the fourth canto, metaphorical king of the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, is just every Paranjana? He's every old eternal person thinking of himself as a king. Which king was that? I was thinking of Paranjana, but since I already... Yes, so here it's true. It's true for a king especially, because there is so much of a centralization of material power within a king. But it's true for every illusioned king, in the sense of him thinking whatever little realm he has put away. There's that one. That was one part of a lecture that I played during the last Govardhan retreat that Prabhupada spoke of as the master's disease. I don't know if any of you heard that one. And he said, everyone from Brahma to an ant, meaning everyone who possesses a false ego, has this same disease of thinking of himself a master. And maybe someone has the nature of his false ego, that he wants to express his mastership over a country, and another one, like a dog, wants to express his mastership over the house and the yard, but still, or an ant, but still the same consciousness, false ego-driven consciousness of master is there. And Krishna consciousness means to change master consciousness to servant consciousness. So this is the result of master consciousness, of king consciousness, and not King Kauri consciousness. Infatuated with his opulence and ruling power, a king loses all self-restraint and cannot obtain his true welfare. Thus bewildered by your illusory energy, he imagines his temporary assets to be permanent. Losing a kingdom, and it will be lost. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments on 10. In three verses, the kings prove how losing a kingdom is due to the mercy of Krishna. With unrestrained pride in his wealth and power, the king thinks his temporary wealth to be permanent. So we read these on two different levels, thinking ourselves kings and all the difficulties that have occurred to us in our lives and our great losses, and see if we can turn them also into Krishna's mercy. Just as men of childish intelligence consider a mirage in the desert to be a pond of water, so those who are irrational look upon the illusory transformation of Maya as substantial. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, the king said, furthermore, the wealth of kingdom and other things are not real wealth unintelligent person see the illusory enjoyments arising from the transformations of the sense objects, just as sound, form, and touch, as real. Just as a fool sees a mirage as water, although it is actually light, foolish kings see the distress arising from the objects of enjoyment as happiness. Seeing the distress, so direct, seeing the distress arising from the objects of enjoyment, the foolish person sees it as happiness. Usually we say, at least we say that it's adyantavanta kantaya, because they, the combining of the senses, indriyas, indriyas, yate, raga, dvesha, we say that sensory happiness, by combining senses with the sense objects, there's happiness, but it's temporary. But he goes right to the, and the temporariness of everything causes suffering, but they go right to the point and say that the happiness is suffering, it's distress, because it's temporary, because we become addicted to it, and then it's gone, it disappears, because our consciousness is shallow, because we just see the combining of the senses and the sense objects, as opposed to seeing deeply, and deeply means our relationship with Krishna being our happiness, our eternal relationship with the Supreme Eternal being our happiness, instead of this temporary flickering combining of the senses of the sense object. And that's compared to what? The mirage in the desert, perceived by a person with childish intelligence, meaning foolish intelligence. Natesu ramate Buddha. Same point, that the wise person doesn't see like this. And then 12 and 13. Previously blinded by the intoxication of riches, we wanted to conquer this earth, and thus we fought one another to achieve victory, mercilessly harassing our own subjects. We arrogantly disregarded you, O Lord, who stood before us as death. But now, O Krishna, that powerful form of yours called time, moving mysteriously and irresistibly. Why is time said to be mysterious? Yeah. And it's mysterious, yeah.
Somehow it makes what is to be what isn't.
And what does it do to what isn't? That's pretty mysterious. What do you mean by that? It makes what is appear to be what isn't. Yeah.
We don't have something.
Or go to the example that was given in the previous verse of it makes us see light as if it's a mirage of water in the desert. We don't see accurately because we project our own mental desires upon something that cannot fulfill those desires. It's illusion. We don't see with our eyes, we see with our minds. We see something as enjoyable while it cannot give us enjoyment at all. So we see what is as it isn't. And also mysterious because you don't know what it's going to give you. You don't know whether the hand is going to open up and there's going to be a scorpion in it or a finely fragrant flower. So that in and of itself is a cause of great excitement if you're into not knowing what's going to happen next in this world. So we arrogantly disregarded you, O Lord, who stood before us as death. But now, O Krishna, that powerful form of yours called time, moving mysteriously and irresistibly. What does irresistibly mean?
Unstoppable.
Time is unstoppable. Loka chaya krit. I am the form of destruction for this world. Now that mysterious force of time has deprived us of our opulences. Now that you have mercifully destroyed our pride, without opulences, we have no cause for pride. If you break up the word Jarasandha, we know that Jarasandha means the witch, the two pieces joined by the witch. The Sandha means joined, and Jara is the name of the witch. But what is another meaning of Jara? Okay. Now read this. What came? They're talking about time, and what was the form of time who destroyed all their opulence? Jarasandha. Isn't that interesting? Now that you have mercifully destroyed our pride, and Prabhupada directly said this, that an old man cannot be proud. Why? Because, and this is what old age is like. It's that just think privately, without disclosing it to anyone. List five things that you're proud of about yourself. Go ahead, do it. Let's really do it. We'll turn it into an experiential teacher TTE thing. Five things about, don't worry, you can write it in invisible ink so none of us will know what it is. No one's doing it.
We're not proud.
And very proud of not being proud too, I know. But what I've seen in life is that one by one, as you get older, all the things that you think are you and that you think are yours, they are removed one by one. I remember when I was young, I used to be so proud of the fact that I can run for 7.3, I think, in miles. Excuse me. How do you convert that into kilometers? How much is 5 miles? Kilometers.
Eight
kilometers. I could just run like that. And I was so proud of it. Now I can't walk without my ankle almost falling off. That whole cause of my pride has been taken away. And one by one, whatever, we're proud of how our body looks, we're proud of our intelligence, we're proud of this, we're proud of that. One by one, the causes of our pride are removed by old age. And therefore, Prabhupada said, an old man cannot be proud. So now that they've learned, time moving mysteriously and irresistibly has destroyed our pride, removed our opulences. Now that you have mercifully destroyed our pride, the last thing that we want in our life is the causes of the things that we have, our opulences that cause our pride, to be removed. The last thing that we want to keep them and even use them in Krishna's service, perhaps. But one by one, because time is irresistible, everything that is not actually ours, because these opulences that we have been gifted with due to our punya, our piety, are not actually ours. And no one should be proud of gifts or borrowed items. If you borrow someone's fast car, beautiful car or motorcycle, you don't become proud of it because it's just borrowed. What's there for me to be proud of? So similarly, when everything is removed that is false from our possession, false causes of pride, what will we actually be left with? So that is Krishna's mercy. Even though no one likes this form of mercy, where he removes the causes of our pride and therefore our pride. Now what do they want? Before, they wanted to conquer other kings and become the number one king And they were, and there's always someone more powerful than the current number one king. And that, in their case, was Jarasandha. And if we continue using the metaphor, he was, time will overwhelm everyone. Old age will overwhelm everyone. More powerful, no matter how kingly we are, time overwhelms and destroys everything for us. And then what do they want at this point when they've come to their senses, giving up desiring all false causes of pride? They want, beg, not only want, they beg. Vinastita pas charanos smaramate. We beg anukampaya. Anukampaya, by your mercy that was all taken away, which were the causes of our pride, and now they only ask charano, the 2 feet, smarama, smarama, may we remember te, your 2 lotus feet. And that is the true wealth of a soul, the remembrance of Krishna's lotus feet. And then the resolve of someone who has come, who is deeply realized. Never again will we hanker for a mirage-like kingdom, a kingdom that must be slavishly served by this mortal body, which is simply a source of disease and suffering, and which is declining at every moment. Nor, O mighty Lord, will we hanker to enjoy the heavenly fruits of pious work in the next life, since the promise of such rewards is simply an empty enticement for the ears. What does that mean in your own words? The heavenly rewards.
It's pleasant when you hear about it and it entices us, but when we are there, we have still not complete fulfillment.
Yes. So that has to do with everything of this world and the next on the material level, all the advertising that we read and hear, and all the mentally concocted plans that our mind puts together for our happiness, that only the if only I had this, then I would be happy and satisfied. If I had on the material level, all these other things that I don't have now, and I see someone else who has them, and I'm envious. There's another king over there whose palace is a little bit better than mine. And someone has 2 hot water bottles instead of 1, and I'm thinking only if I had 2, because this one's starting to get a bit cool now. And then I'll be happy, and then I'll be happy, and then, oh, if only, and the envy and the torture of seeing people have what I don't have, and makes me think that I'll be happy if only I had that. This type of mentality is just, what is it compared to? It's empty enticement for the ears and mind. There's no substance there. It is just a bluff of the material energy. And that's specifically the job of the material energy, to bluff us into icha dvesha samutena, to bluff us into believing that I want and I don't want on the level of material life. We'll read the comments of Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur from 12 to 14. The king said, we ourselves exemplify this. Wanting to conquer the earth, we competed with each other, not seeing you standing before us as death. Previously, we were intoxicated with pride, and today we have lost our power by the influence of time, which is none other than you. Please give us your mercy so that we will always remember your lotus feet. We realize that losing our kingdoms was all due to your mercy. Henceforth we shall no longer desire a beautiful kingdom, which is desired by men under the spell of illusion. These kings have to be served by the body. Kingdoms have to be served by their body, by the body, which itself can be destroyed at any moment, and which is the home of disease. Such kingdoms only give sorrow. Moreover, one who has acquired a kingdom is obliged to perform Ashwamedha Yagyas and other costly sacrifices. Neither do we desire to attain Swargaloka, which only sounds pleasurable to the ears because of the continuous competition in heaven. Everyone we see is a potential threat, because I want something and someone else may take it from me and get it when I still want it. Everyone is a threat to me. Like here on earth, there is no happiness there either. So when Krishna rescues one, this is the mood that one should adopt. Please tell us how we may constantly remember your lotus feet, though we continue in the cycle of birth and death in this world. So that's their question. They beg him, please allow us to, and they say, ask, how is it possible that I can remember your lotus feet? I heard something a few days ago, a memory of one devotee, Ribhati Nandana Prabhu, speaking about Prabhupada, where they did something and Prabhupada became very angry at them. Very angry. They did something, the devotees did something improper. So then after, Ribhati Nandana Prabhu and all the devotees, they felt bad, really bad. Said done something to displease Prabhupada. So Ribhati Nandana Prabhu went in to see Prabhupada in his room. And he asked Nanda Kumar, can I go see Prabhupada? And he said, look in and see if he calls you in. So this was in London, I think. So he put his head in and Prabhupada said, yes, can I come in? He said, yes, come in. And Prabhupada wasn't the least bit angry at all at that time. So he apologized profusely. And Prabhupada said, it's all right. No, never mind. And he was so angry just before, and now he wasn't angry at all. So he asked him, not saying, he was trying to understand the mentality of Prabhupada, such a pure devotee. But if he would have said, Prabhupada, how are you thinking? You wouldn't have. You're a pure devotee, but he didn't ask like that because he knew that Prabhupada wouldn't accept that he was a pure devotee. But instead, he just asked about how does a pure devotee act, and he could be angry at one moment, and at the next moment, there's nothing there. And Prabhupada, if I remember correctly, described it like, the consciousness of a pure devotee is deep like an ocean. So on the surface, there may be some ripples, but you just go down a little bit and it's calm and peaceful because of its shelter in Krishna. So what does that mean to be deep in Krishna consciousness, deep as an ocean? It means that at the depth of your consciousness, you're living in your relationship with Krishna, your remembrance of Krishna. Remembrance of Krishna comes from the depth of relationship with Krishna. So if our relationship is superficial with Krishna, then it is always being knocked over. And if our relationship is deep with Krishna, it's so substantial that nothing can knock it over or remove it or pull it out or anything like that. So they ask, can we always remember you? And then they ask how. Is it possible? In 15, please tell us. They don't want anything else. Excuse me, they asked for before. They said, we don't want anything. We beg simply to remember your lotus feet. And then in 15, they ask, how can they do this? Which is a very important question for devotees. And especially, how can we do it while in the world, so we continue in the cycle of birth and death in this world? So the purport here, the BBT purport, is as follows. One can constantly remember the Lord only by His mercy. Such remembrance is the easy method to obtain supreme liberation, as explained in the Bhagavad Gita 8:14. Ananya chaita satatam yumam smarati nityasa tasyaham sulava parta nitya yuktasya yogina. For one who always remembers me without deviation, I am easy to obtain, O son of Pritha, because of his constant engagement in devotional service. The word api samsaratam iha indicates that the kings were approaching Lord Krishna not merely for liberation, but rather for the boon of always being able to remember his lotus feet. Such constant remembrance is a symptom of love, and love of Godhead, meaning not liberation, is the actual goal. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments on 15 as follows. Krishna replies, Just take the boon of Sayuja Mukti. No, no, they reply in this verse. Please teach us the exact method that we can understand and execute, by which we will never forget your lotus feet. The exact method by which we can never forget your lotus feet. We have no desire to end the samsara, nor do we desire that which is most sought after, namely prema bhakti. It is due to the rise of humility in them that they do not desire this. Because they don't, if you notice, they ask as we continue in this world. So they're not thinking that we deserve to be out of this world. So they're not asking even for prema bhakti due to their humility. The kings do not use the term, please give it to us, but rather say, samadisha, please instruct us, which shows clearly the highest degree of qualities like humility, sense control, and freedom from material desires, which are necessary qualifications for bhakti. Again and again, we offer our obeisances to Lord Krishna, Hari, the son of Vasudeva. That supreme soul, Govinda, vanquishes the suffering of all who surrender to him. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and that's the end of their prayers in 16, says, the kings laid down with all limbs touching the ground to offer respect to Krishna. How many were there? 800. The kings, 20,800 kings laid down with all eight limbs. So how many limbs is that? 20,800 times eight. So too many limbs. Then they engaged in Krishna Nam Sankirtan. Because the verse says, again and again we offer obeisances to the Lord Krishna Hari, the son of Vasudeva. That's the 16th verse. The supreme soul, Govinda, vanquishes the suffering of all who surrender to him. So the Sanskrit is to that verse. Krishnaya Vasudevaya Haraye Paramatmane Pranataklesha Govindaya Namo Nama. Everyone. Krishnaya Vasudevaya Haraye Paramatmane Pranataklesha Govindaya Namo Nama. Krishnaya Vasudevaya Haraye Paramatmane Pranataklesha Govindaya Namo Nama. The kings laid down with all eight limbs touching the ground to offer respect to Krishna. They then engaged in Nam Sankirtan. Krishnaya Vasudevaya Haraye Govindaya, while requesting the Lord to mercifully teach them, even though they were unqualified. The kings sang, we offer our repeated obeisances unto Vasudeva Krishna, the original personality of Godhead, who appeared from Vasudeva out of compassion for all living entities. To Hari, who delivers even the demons from the sufferings of the material world, to the Paramatma, who appears as the super soul for the devotees in Shantaras and as the source of the supreme prema for the devotees in Dasyaras, to the destroyer of the miseries, Klesha Nashaya. So notice that Dasyaras, excuse me just for a moment. Who appears, the Paramatma, who appears as the super soul for the devotees in Shantaras and as the source of supreme prema for the devotees in Dasyaras. serving mood as opposed to a meditative mood. To the destroyer of the miseries, Klesha Nashaya, which create obstacles to bhakti for the sadhaka. Sadhaka bhaktis. Is that interesting too? That miseries create obstacles for the sadhaka bhaktis. And to Govinda, who reaches out, vindate, our senses, such as the eyes, ears, and nose, in order to give the nectar of his beauty, fragrance, and sweet-sounding voice. 17. Sukadeva Goswami said, this is Krishna's reply, in 6 verses, thus the kings, now freed from bondage, glorified the Supreme Lord. Then, my dear Parikit, that merciful bestower of shelter spoke to them in a gentle voice. So what is, he's going to, they've asked him a question. What was the question? How can we remember you? But that wasn't all.
Please instruct us in the exact
manner. Please exact, in the exact matter?
But
what was the rest of it? Remember him? As we perform our duties in the world, how can we remember? So this is very, very relevant for people who are in the world, because if we forget Krishna, all is lost. Smatavya satatam Vishnu smatavya na jatu chit sarva vidhi na sheda cha. So this is what Krishna says. From now on, my dear kings, you will have firm devotion to me, the Supreme Self and the Lord of all that be. I assure you that this will come to pass, just as you desire. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments on 18. By addressing the kings as Bhuva, O rulers and nourishers of the earth, Krishna implies, since you revealed your true nature as my devotees in your statement of Tanna Samadishopayam, therefore you will nourish the entire earth by spreading upon it the nectar of the practice of bhakti. I promise that just as you desired, your devotion will become very fixed. I will instruct and you will understand, practice, and then attain firm remembrance of me. So, understand, practice, and obtain. Understand, practice, and obtain. If we don't understand, but then try and practice, we will not obtain. If we understand, but don't practice, we will not obtain. So we have to understand and then practice. Prema bhakti will gradually appear from such uninterrupted remembrance. So quite a process is described here already, the stages of it. Understanding, practicing, obtaining remembrance, and then from that comes prema bhakti. At the present time, you will attain steadiness in practice, sadhana, so then you put a nishta in there. So there's sadhana, anishtita, and the nishta. And then you will quickly attain the goal, the sadhya. From today on, you will experience ever fresh spiritual realizations. So would that be nice? To every day experience ever fresh spiritual realizations? So by Krishna's mercy, that is the first thing that's said out of mercy. This will happen. And we spoke about mercy previously. Fortunately, you have come, this is 19, you have come to the proper conclusion, my dear kings, and what you have spoken is true. I can see that human beings' lack of restraint, which arises from their intoxication with opulence and power, simply leads to madness. 19, Vishwanath. Sri Krishna said, "You are very fortunate to have resolve that devotional service alone should be performed. Most worldly kings are mad after sense enjoyment and bound by Maya. From wealth, Sri, comes the concept of power, Aishwarya. From Aishwarya comes intoxication, Mada. From intoxication comes bondage, Unaham. The word Pasha, Si, is poetic form of Pashyami. 20. Hai Hai Nahusha, Vena, Ravana, Naraka, and many other rulers of demigods, men and demons, fell from their elevated positions because of infatuation with material opulence. 21. Understanding that this material body and everything, so here's the instructions, is havoc, because here's the problem, that material opulences, and again, everyone has opulences, tend to make us proud, and the pride makes us fall down. And the kings had said, thank you for removing the cause of our opulences, which removed the cause of our pride, which caused us to take shelter of you. But now they're asking for instructions. How can we live in this world? And we can't live in this world without opulences, without some abilities. So how can we do it while remembering you? And what gets in the way of remembering is intoxication due to pride and thinking that things are meant for our pleasure, and they no longer want that type of consciousness. So here he's giving them the instructions how to do it. And it's quite interesting. I'll read them all. And I want you to tell me the essence after having heard them all so carefully. Here are the instructions. Understanding that this material body and everything connected with it have a beginning and an end. Worship me by Vedic sacrifices. And with clear intelligence, protect your subjects in accordance with the principles of religion. As you live your lives, begetting generations of progeny and encountering happiness and distress, birth and death, always keep your mind fixed on me. Be detached from the body and everything connected to it. Remaining self-satisfied, steadfastly keep your vows while concentrating your minds fully on me. In this way, you'll ultimately attain me, the Supreme Absolute Truth. That was Krishna's instructions. So what did he say? In response to their question, how can we remember you by being in this world?
Be beyond duality.
Be beyond duality. Go ahead.
So whatever pleasant and unpleasant comes, see that it has a beginning and an end. So therefore, be detached.
Understanding that this material body and everything connected with it have a beginning and an end, worship me by Vedic sacrifices. So they're supposed to do their duties. And with clear intelligence. So do your duties, but understand the philosophy of reality, what the nature of matter is, what the nature of spirit is. With clear intelligence, protect your subjects in accordance with the principles of religion. So he's telling them to act according to the principles of religion, do your duties in a dharmic way, and act according to the principles of religion, and work with proper understanding of things as they are, and as you live your lives, begetting generations of progeny, which is the part of the duty of a king, and encountering happiness and distress, the unavoidable occurrence of happiness and distress. It's going to happen. What should I do when I encounter happiness and distress? Birth and death. Always keep your minds fixed on me. Be detached from the body and everything connected to it. Remaining self-satisfied. Be in the world. Do your duty. Beget progeny. Protect your citizens piously. But be detached from the body and everything connected to it by proper understanding. Remain self-satisfied. Steadfastly keep your vows while concentrating your minds fully on me. So again, concentrate your mind fully on me. Concentrate your mind fully on me. But the question was, how can I do it? And the answer very much is by concentrating your mind on me. That's how you can concentrate your mind on me. Of course, there's the be detached from matter. That's the stuff that you can't have your mind focused on. That's what we spoke about in the beginning. You can't have both. That was the first point that was remembered practically. Remember that in the beginning of the class? I asked what do you remember from yesterday's class? And it was verse 10. And what that was what?
Sin. Others will control senses. They cannot conquer.
They cannot conquer Krishna. They cannot focus the mind on Krishna. Because sense gratification and Krishna consciousness go ill together. They don't work well together. So keep your vows while concentrating your mind fully on me. You have to keep your mind somehow or another. We have to learn the art of keeping our minds on Krishna somehow or another and keeping life in its proper perspective about what the purpose of life is. And in 15, the beginning of the purport, the first line is, one can constantly remember the Lord only by His mercy. How can you always remember Krishna? Though living in the world, you do these things, but always remember Him. And how can you always remember Him? It's really only constant. It's only constant when it's going to be by His mercy. So then the question changes. Well, how can I get the mercy of Krishna? Okay. Thank you. I was hoping someone would be able to tell me. Yes. By the mercy of the Vaishnava, by the mercy of the Guru, by Gurus, by mercy, by mercy, by mercy. This is the reality of the situation, is that we're dependent on mercy. So this is, and he says it, and Krishna says it, that keep your vows. In this way you will ultimately attain me, the Supreme Absolute Truth. In the end you'll attain me. Eventually, just like I made you wait for months and months and months in prison. And then eventually I came. Well, why didn't you come earlier? Well, how can an insignificant conditioned soul make that demand? You must give me mercy now. Well, why should I? Well, here's my reasons. But then it's not mercy, because mercy means causeless. It means it's just descending. So when if we here are my reasons, that means you're putting forward your case, which means you want justice. So if you want justice, then you'll get justice. But if you want mercy, you have to be patient. You have to wait for Him to bestow it on you. Sukadev Goswami said, text 24. We'll just read to the end. There's no purports. Then we'll have ended this chapter. Sukadev Goswami said, having thus instructed the kings, Krishna, the supreme master of all the worlds, engaged male and female servants in bathing and grooming them. So after telling them to be, they don't want any sense gratification anymore. They don't want to be kings anymore. And Krishna says, be detached. Now look how he's going to treat them. O descendant of Bharata, the Lord then had King Sahadev. That's whose son is King Sahadev? Honor them with offerings of clothing, jewelry, garlands, and sandalwood paste, all suitable for royalty. After they had been properly bathed and adorned, Lord Krishna saw to it that they dined on excellent food. He also presented them with various items befitting the pleasures of kings, such as betel nuts. Honored by Lord Mukunda and freed from tribulation, the king shone splendidly, their earrings gleaming, just as the moon and other celestial bodies shine brilliantly in the sky at the end of the rainy season. So after Krishna, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, after Krishna relieved their distress, they appeared resplendent and so wonderful. But Krishna had mercifully promised them that don't worry, you'll be able to remember me as you, because it's your desire. And I'm going to put you, I'm giving you back your position as kings. But it's not going to be a hindrance for you because you have my mercy. Then the Lord arranged for the kings to be seated on chariots drawn by fine horses and adorned with jewels and gold, and pleasing them with gracious words, he sent them off to their own kingdoms. Isn't that amazing? I mean, they all decided to become devotees. The easiest way for them to remember him was to stay with him all the time. And Krishna just dressed them up, gave them gracious words, put them on their chariots and sent them home. And then, that's so interesting, amazing how Krishna deals with his devotees. Thus liberated from all difficulties by Krishna, the greatest of personalities, the kings departed, and as they went, they thought only of him, the Lord of the universe, and of his wonderful deeds. So they weren't bewildered by any of their regained opulences. They just thought of him and his mercy, because it was he who saved them. The kings told their ministers and other associates what the personality of Godhead had done, and then they diligently carried out the orders he had imparted to them. So what does it mean, since we're in the land of metaphor today, what does it mean that he told them, the kings told the ministers and other associates what the personality of Godhead had done? What does it mean when someone who is rescued by Krishna tells others about Krishna? He's doing the preaching. Kirtan. Kirtan means, sankirtan means preaching. Preaching. This was one of the great, and Prabhupada said this, the great contributions of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He expanded the meaning of what sankirtan is to include what it really is the, everything connected to kirtan, the glorification of Krishna. So we ask, why did Krishna do this? Why did Krishna just send them home? And here we can see an answer. He wanted others, them to help others. But they had his blessings. 31. Having arranged for Bhimasen to kill Jarasandha, Lord Kesava accepted worship from King Sahadev and then departed with the two sons of Pritha. When they arrived at Indraprastha, the victorious heroes blew their conch shells. So all this interesting, amazingly, we've touched a teeny bit of the depths according to our abilities of what was going on, but just imagine how wonderful it was. Krishna, this most beautiful, powerful, unlimitedly beautiful and powerful person, performs these kind of pastimes, and then he just moves on to the next amazingly beautiful, powerful pastime. And then he does that for his whole stay, from the very first day of his so-called birth to the very last day where he leaves. He's performing one, and then he goes on and performs them somewhere else. So when they arrived at Indraprastha, the victorious heroes blew their conch shells, bringing joy to their well-wishing friends and sorrow to their enemies. The residents of Indraprastha were now very pleased to hear that sound, for they understood that now the king of Magadha had been put to rest. That's a polite way to say he was dead. Put to gentle rest. But it's true also, Magadham Shantam. Because he was a demon, so demons can't be peaceful or restful. So now he had achieved something. He was, how could you be restful and peaceful when you're inimical of someone who's all, when you're envious of someone who's all pervading? So that means you're always going to, everywhere you look, you'll see him and be disturbed. The residents of Indraprastha were very pleased to hear that sound, for they understood that now the king of Magadha had been put to rest. King Yudhisthira felt that his desires were now fulfilled. Yudhisthira, so what does it sound like? His desires were now fulfilled. So now he was happy because he felt that his desires were now fulfilled. Huh? What does it sound like? It sounds like, what was his desires?
His desire was to glorify Krishna.
Oh, but what does it sound like? Not for the people who read ahead.
It sounds like he was trying to get rid of the king.
Just like the kings were saying, with the problems when you're a king, is everyone's your competitor and you're always trying to put them down and kill them and everything, and you're always in anxiety about that. So it sounds as if Yudhisthira was in anxiety because of Jarasandha's presence, because he was not surrendering when to him being the emperor, and now the obstacle, the last obstacle for he thinks to him being the performing the Rajasuya sacrifice and declaring himself the emperor of the world has been removed. But devotees, regardless of what it appears that they're thinking, they're thinking something else. They're thinking of Krishna and Krishna's pleasure, because that's what it means to be a devotee. That's what it means to be deep. Bhim, Arjuna, and Jarasandha offered their respects to the king and informed him fully about what they had done. Yudhisthira was stunned in ecstasy and could not speak. And the final verse in this chapter. Upon hearing their account of the great favor Lord Keshava had mercifully shown him, King Dharmaraj had shed tears of ecstasy. He felt such love, he could not say anything. He was ecstatic. Because there are so many levels that we see this on, but one of the levels, and perhaps the main level, is not Krishna killing all the demons, but rather Krishna, class dismissed. It's over. Rather, Krishna exchanging love with his devotees. Thank you. Now it's 12:30. We'll see you 1 o'clock.